And we're back with the reporter's file, everyone. My name is Saeed Pourreza. These are the headlines for this segment. How a former UK Prime Minister has made his millions. The state of the Tunisian economy. The Alawite Shia community in Turkey. And the popularity of a career in government among university graduates in China. Tony Blair, one of the most controversial figures of the 21st century. Statesman to some, war criminal to others, and a very, very rich man. Since leaving office, Blair Incorporated has raked in the millions. But how? Well, Narges Mobalri investigates the sometimes hidden fortunes of a former prime minister.
Tony Blair, the popular man of the people who waged a war and became, for many, enemy number one. He spent a decade as prime minister. But what has he been doing since?
When Tony Blair left office in June 2007, he was a polarising figure. And since then, his Iraq War legacy has tainted and followed him around wherever he goes. But Tony doesn't care about insignificant details like that these days. He's too busy building his global business empire, estimated at being worth tens of millions of pounds. But where exactly does his money come from?
He's on a lecturing tour where he gets anything from $200,000 upward for doing a one-hour show. Secondly, he runs a number of charities where he invites people to have dinner with him, charging anything from £1,500 upward for people to join him. That's sort of, if you like, chicken feed in some ways for the income that he gets. He does consultancy, you know, whatever consultancy may mean. He advises governments on investment strategies. You know, it's on record that he's advising the Qatari government, the Saudi government. Plus, he was advising Mr. Gaddafi before his demise.
All this work has amassed Tony Blair a fortune estimated at £60 million. Setting him up to enter the country's rich list this year.
This is Tony Blair HQ, where all the magic happens. His latest venture, the stock markets. Blair has set up his own trading desk here, headed by a former managing director of Barclays Capital.
I've met up with David Lawley-Wakelin outside the offices. Last year, he interrupted Tony Blair's evidence at the Leveson inquiry to call him a war criminal.
The man is a war criminal!
We're outside Tony Blair HQ. What do we know about what goes on in there?
Not an actual lot, and that in there is Tony Blair Associates. But very cleverly, his accountants have managed to have a web of partnerships set up with a firm called Windrush Associates, whereby he's managed to not have his public accounts shown up.
Blair has two separate trading arms, Firerush Ventures, that deals with his consultancy firm Tony Blair Associates, and Windrush Ventures, that deals with his governmental consultancy. That all looks simple enough on the surface, but actually, behind these two companies is a complex web of 12 different legal entities. The mystifying framework involves highly specialised limited partnerships and parallel companies, and Tony's partners are kept secret. Take, for example, Windrush Ventures No. 3 LP, partnership between an entity owned by Blair himself and an anonymous off-the-shelf company known only as BDBCO No. 819. We don't know who owns it, but we do know its shares are listed as being held by a second off-the-shelf entity, this time called BDBCO No. 822. Surprise, surprise, we don't know who owns that either. Confused? Well, maybe that's the point.
Anyone who is trying to hide money, create this web of complexity so that ordinary people or governments even are unable to understand where the money is coming, how it is coming, where is it going.
The invisible network of Tony Blair is propped up by the visible face of his charities, Tony Blair Africa Governance Initiative, Tony Blair Faith Foundation, Breaking the Climate Deadlock, and the Tony Blair Sports Foundation.
It's hard to work out not just the extent of his wealth, but where the dividing line between charity and corporation is, and just how intermeshed they are.
Oh, and of course, don't forget his extensive property portfolio.
He has a country house just outside London in the Chiltern Hills, where he's amassing a collection of 18th century paintings. I mean, this takes some money to own a country house in England, but he has numerous properties, I mean, probably going into double figures in both this country, the United States, and I understand in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt as well.
He was known back in the days when he was a lawyer, back in his chambers. I've spoken to lawyers from his chambers who say the one thing they always said about Tony Blair was he was greedy.
But is it just greed that is fueling Tony Blair's growing empire?
There is an international corporate and political elite. You sometimes catch sight of them gathering at places like the Bilderberg Conference or at Davos. And they are a global elite who have enormous concentrations of both wealth and political power at their command. And Tony Blair has always had an aspiration to be at that table, to be a prominent player in that kind of league. And that's exactly what he's pursuing in his post-government career.
Tony Blair's business empire is certainly global. JP Morgan pay him £2.5 million a year. He advises Zurich Financial Services. He negotiates deals for monarchies like Saudi Arabia and Qatar. He works with the Rwandan president and has negotiated a new deal with Kazakhstan worth £16 million.
He received in 2009 over £20 million from the Kuwaiti royal family, obviously Saddam Hussein's old enemies. Another deal he did, the one which really got me upset, because there were bombs again going off at the time in Iraq, was a deal with UI Energies, which is a Korean oil firm who had extensive deals in Iraq and as well as in America. In other words, whilst the Iraq war in 2008 was still raging, he was doing deals with oil companies at that time.
After I spoke to David Lawley-Wakelin, he insisted on knocking on Tony Blair's office doors to ask a few questions of his own.
It's David Lawley-Wakelin. I'm a private citizen of this country. I'd just like to ask a question of Mr. Tony Blair.
We were asked to wait for someone to come down, but they changed their mind, and instead they called the police on us, quite a few of them too. It seems we won't be getting any service or answers from Tony Blair today, and his office didn't respond to my request for comment either. But I doubt Tony Blair will be able to avoid these questions for long. Nagus Mwaleri for Reporters File.
Can we ask you, the people inside are called the police, did they?
Yes, they did.
Thank you.
It's been more than 2 years since the revolution in Tunisia, and the cost of living in the North African country has been following an upward trend. The country's economy is said to be in free fall, sending prices, especially gas prices, soaring. And the people have been vocal in expressing their anger. Adnan Shoshi reports.
Over the past 6 months, the Tunisian government approved a 14% rise in the prices of gas. The goal of the unexpected taxation is to increase national revenues in order to overcome the economic crisis, which hit the North African country after the revolution of the 14th of January, 2011. Gas station employees have noticed the spread of hostile behaviors from customers who are reacting negatively to the taxation. For the past 20 years, Lutfi Ayari has been in contact with drivers. He confirmed the fact that people have recently adopted an aggressive attitude.
The recent increase is unjustified. This is an irresponsible behavior. We are under tension and we have many problems with customers who think the money will go into our pockets while the government is the only beneficiary.
Taxi drivers and ordinary citizens are angry at the rising prices of gas, which have affected the budget of transportation in Tunisia. Taxi drivers have organized a 24-hour strike to protest the 14% taxation they consider unjust. According to taxi owners, the extra charges they have supported since October 2012 should have been staggered on 5 years.
Gas prices go up and never go down. People can no longer afford to take a taxi. It's expensive for clients and costly for drivers. We are losing money, it's sad. But I have fired my assistant because I couldn't pay his salary with the skyrocketing prices of gas.
With reduced transportation budgets and stagnant salaries, ordinary citizens feel the impact of the economic crisis.
Life is very expensive after the revolution. We are not living but rather surviving. One has to choose between feeding the kids or paying for gas and transportation.
Since the approval of the new prices of gas by the authorities, civil society activists have staged daily silent rallies in front of the National Constituent Assembly. People waved banners describing the situation as unbearable, not only for the poor, but also for the middle class. According to Lutfi Khaldi, president of the Tunisian Association for the Defense of Consumers, the middle class represented the majority in the society before the revolution. Khaldi adds that this important social class has witnessed a sharp reduction in comparison with the poor class.
The Association for the Protection of Consumers has received thousands of angry people. This is an alarming situation. The poor are suffering while the middle class will disappear from the social ladder. The finance ministry did not consider the impact of the 14% tax increase on the lives of Tunisians who are really fed up. We are calling for a national boycott of the unnecessary products.
4 months, the feeling of uncertainty about the future discouraged businessmen from investing in new projects, as the risk of losing money has become too high. Experts link the growing unemployment rate and the absence of new projects to the high cost of transportation.
Yet the costly transportation will slow down the investment pace in the remote regions and cause more unemployment. The government is spending more than its revenues and it wants to compensate through taxes. The new finance minister has a challenging task. He has made the wrong decision. The ministry should have consulted experts.
Finance Minister Idriss Farfir defended the decision of his government. He explained that the sudden increase in the prices of products, including gas, is the result of the lasting economic crisis. The minister added that the political instability in the post-revolution era could justify the economic difficulties.
There are many pressures on the state budget. I acknowledge the fact that Tunisia has internal political challenges and economic difficulties after the revolution. I'm not justifying the inflation, but rather trying to provide a rational explanation. We have also been affected by the economic crisis in Europe. We need to reduce the budget deficit to avoid bankruptcy. We must make sacrifices for our country.
The National Constituent Assembly witnessed heated debates between opposition and ruling parties about the new national budget. MP Salim Abdeslam raised the issue of the declining purchasing power and slammed the inefficiency of the economic strategies of the government.
The role of MPs is to defend the purchasing power of Tunisians. The economic recovery won't work and the objectives of the revolution won't be achieved if the increase in taxes and the prices of gas is the unique strategy of the government. The assembly can turn a blind eye of the impoverishment of the people.
Observers believe the debate over the challenging living conditions of ordinary Tunisians will last 4 years. Only days after the approval of the new prices of gas, additional taxes have been announced. From now on, consumers will pay 7% more for water and electricity, an increase which could trigger a new wave of protests across Tunisia.
The economic crisis which hit Tunisia after the revolution has complicated the lives of millions of people. Tunisians believe that the skyrocketing prices of gas will only deepen the crisis. Adnan Shawachi for Reporters File, Tunis.
Turkey has a population of some 75 million. According to the most recent census, Alawites account for some 25% of that figure. But despite their numbers, these Shia Muslims feel they're being bulldozed by their country's foreign policy in the region. Serena Shim reports from Hatay, home to a thriving community of Alawites.
As the Middle East is shaken up along sectarian fault lines, cracks are opening within Turkey, where an increasingly impatient Alawite minority is feeling sidelined and persecuted by their country's alignment with Sunni powers in the region.
There is a plan to take down Assad because he is Alawite and Nur al-Maliki because he is Shiite. Prime Minister Erdogan stands, and this situation shows that he is aligning himself with Sunnis, and that leads to sectarian tension between Shiites and Sunnis.
According to members of Turkey's Alawite community, which is considered an offshoot of Shiite Islam, the government is aligning Turkey with a regional Sunni front. It is also trying to create an internal front between Sunni and Shiite within the Turkish society. Antakya is home to the largest Alawite population in Turkey. However, the community here does not receive the same treatment as the larger Sunni majority, as most of Turkish media is government-owned and foreign media does not have the right to move freely. Their views and opinions are rarely seen by the mass public. Alawites and Shiites alike are offended by the treatment they receive by the Turkish government. They claim the government builds Sunni mosques and trains salaried Sunni clerks with taxpayer dollars, with the exclusion of other faiths.
In Turkey, the schools only teach Sunni Islam. We want to learn things about our religion as well. They will not even let us make our own mosques. The Turkish government makes lies about our religion to try and scare the Turkish population. We used to be scared to say we are Alawites. The Turkish government sees us as second-class citizens. Our population is 20 million, but they treat us like we don't exist.
America and Israel are trying to give the entire region to the Muslim Brotherhood. This is against democracy and human rights. The Muslim Brotherhood has taken over Egypt, Iraq, and Libya. Our country is next.
Members of the Alawite faith claim this is a form of oppression against the strong population currently residing in Turkey today.
There is no democracy in Turkey. America claims they want to make Syria a democracy. Why don't they try making Turkey a democracy first? There is one Alawite out of every three Sunnis, but we have no rights. They give Sunni clerics and schools money from taxpayer dollars, but nothing to Alawites and Christians.
According to the Turkish constitution, Turkey is supposed to be a secular state. However, the annual $3 billion budget allocated to the Religious Affairs Department is only given to Sunni Islam. Alawites claim Turkey is not a secular state, but rather a Sunni state, whose state-run Religious Affairs Department serves only Sunni Islam. Unlike Sunnis, Shiites and Alawites have to pay for their own mosques and clerics from their own pockets.
We have a population of 20 million Alawite in the north, south, and east of Turkey. We as a Turkish society are supposed to be secular, but that's not true. Sunnis are controlling everything. There are 81 provinces in Turkey. Not one of them are run by Alawite leadership. There are 81 muftis. Not one of them is Alawite. There is not one Alawite minister in all of Turkey.
Turkish Shiite have been following recent shifts in Turkey's foreign policy along a perceived Sunni-Shiite divide happening in the Middle East. As Turkey sides with Sunni forces in Syria and Iraq and allies itself with countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, it has been distancing itself from countries like Syria and Iran. In sermons and speeches, Alawite leaders have been asking why Turkey supports Sunni rebels in Syria, but not Shiite protesters in Bahrain, and why Syria is condemned as a dictatorship, while Saudi Arabia remains an ally. Turkey's Alawite population has become ever more fearful of its country's alliance with major Sunni powerhouses around the region. They feel that it is all part of a plan constructed by the United States to systematically push out Alawites and Shiites from the entire Middle East. Serena Shim, Press TV, Hatay, Turkey.
While university graduates in other countries dream of becoming doctors or lawyers or setting up their own businesses, in China today, the most popular career choice for graduates by far is a job in the civil service. Numbers applying to work for the government have ballooned, expanding 30 times over the past decade. Stephen Ribe reports from the capital, Beijing, on what that says about where the country stands today.
China is seeing an explosion in the volume of graduates seeking to enter its civil service. Numbers registering to sit the government's entrance exam have risen 30-fold in the past decade. While some say this trend will give China the capable government it needs, others see in it much of what is wrong with the Chinese economy today.
This is the Capital University of Economics and Business in the northeast of Beijing, which is today acting as a test center for the annual local government civil service exam. You can see that behind me, there are hundreds of candidates going in, although this is just one of 150 such test centers, because today in the city, 67,000 people are sitting the exam. And that's just to work for the local government of Beijing.
For the last recruitment round of central government, no fewer than 1.5 million hopefuls sat the exam, even though there were only positions for one in 70 of them. Song Qiang, who graduated last year, explains the attraction.
In Chinese society today, civil servants not only enjoy high status, but also a stable, even good salary. Chinese parents expect their children to achieve. A job in the government is a way to satisfy them.
As Professor Zhang Ming of Renmin University explains, the high regard in which civil servants are held has a long history in China.
China has been an empire run by bureaucrats for thousands of years. A measure by which a man is judged in our society is still his ability to pass the civil service exam and enter the government. It's an achievement that brings glory to both a candidate and his extended family.
In the 1990s, following China's economic reforms, it briefly became fashionable for graduates to work in foreign companies or even start their own businesses. But two recent developments have since reversed this trend.
Firstly, the huge stimulus spending that China embarked on after the global financial crisis increased the government's hold on the economy by funneling billions of dollars through local governments to state-owned infrastructure builders like Baosteel here behind me.
Secondly, an expansion of China's higher education system has led to a five-fold increase in annual graduate numbers, even as the economy has slowed. Although the small proportion of applicants who succeed may gain status and security, is the trend of such huge numbers applying good for China? At the elite Peking University, Professor Bai Zheli thinks it is.
China today is facing enormous challenges. Solving these challenges and pushing forward China's development will of course be easier if the government can pick the brightest and most talented graduates.
China's leaders may indeed want good administrators, yet more often they say that to join the rich world, their country needs a culture of innovation. Experts worry that instead of setting up a Chinese Google or Apple, the country's best minds are being devoted to playing the game of power. And a bigger concern still is corruption.
In China, the richest people are not entrepreneurs, but civil servants. They don't appear on our rich lists because they are careful to hide their wealth. As the saying goes, once you have power, that gives you everything else.
Whatever the truth, the belief that attaining high office is a sure path to wealth is widely held in China.
People in government have power. When normal citizens have something that needs doing, they will seek their help, and that gives them lots of extra income.
Working for the government gives you financial stability. In China, there are few easy opportunities to have your own business.
In China, when you have political connections, it's much easier to run a successful business. So officials are comparatively rich.
2 years ago, Russia's then president, Dmitry Medvedev, said he was greatly worried that the popularity of employment in his country's civil service indicated a high level of corruption.
Given that China's new president, Xi Jinping, has said that fighting corruption is his priority, the same trend now underway in his own country might also be giving him cause for concern. Stephen Ribe, Press TV, Beijing.
This has been the Reporter's File, everyone. Thank you for watching us. Make sure you join us again right here on Press TV next week. Goodbye.